Ghabremadine versus Ashcroft, Ms. Bisciotti.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honors. The only person who has a last name longer than mine is the petitioner in this case, and I can appreciate the court's inability to finish the name. I've had some problems myself.
Well, how is it pronounced?
Well,
it's your client. You know how to
pronounce it. I call him Ghabre myself because it's so much simpler. I didn't do that in the brief, however. I also call myself something else, too, but I'd rather not mention that this morning. This is an instance of an individual who came to the United States on January 30th, 1997, applied for asylum because he alleged that being a Jehovah's Witness, he would be persecuted if he returned to Eritrea. The asylum officer denied the application and referred him to the immigration court. He was served with a notice to appear on January 30th of 1998, approximately a little over 10 months after his initial arrival. He appeared before the immigration judge, reasserted his application for asylum. The judge found that he had not established his past persecution sufficient to grant him asylum, and then he ordered him deported to Eritrea.
Do you think this is a case like Muhor where a remand is required for more clear findings as to whether or not Mr. Ghabremadine was or is a Jehovah's Witness? Well, was.
Well, the easy answer is, of course. But the other answer is that he at the time that the judge demanded this proof by saying you were a Jehovah's Witness for 14 years in Eritrea, how come you don't have an identification card? How come you don't have a letter? Well, the short answer is that Ethiopia barred Jehovah's Witnesses from practicing their religion, and he told the judge, I don't have any proof because my religion was banned. I wouldn't have an identification card on my person because if I did, they'd take me to jail. But the judge ignored that. And he also ignored the fact that this was the type of a religion that he was forced to practice in secret. And this is where Muhr, M-U-H-U-R, versus Ashcroft is directly applicable. In Muhr, the applicant had not been a Jehovah's Witness in Ethiopia or Eritrea prior to leaving it. She became a Jehovah's Witness, went to live with her husband in the Middle East, and then came to the United States, had never suffered any of the kind of past persecution that Ghabre has suffered in this case. The judge denied the application. This court reversed, saying that if a person is forced to practice their religion in secret, that's persecution. So, obviously, perhaps a remand might be helpful in enlightening it with some directions from this court. But I think this is a clear case where the judge erred as a matter of law and as a matter of fact in demanding a higher burden of proof than this petitioner could reasonably present. The other issue that is of some great concern to me is the way this process was handled. We have given a great deal of argument to the question of whether or not the deportation order should have automatically ensued at the conclusion of proceedings. This bothers me because there is a statutory provision in the IRA-IRA that says that a person who has been served with a notice to appear and who has been physically present in the United States less than a year, if he requests a hearing for any reason, will forfeit statutory eligibility for asylum at the conclusion of proceedings. I don't know that Congress really thought this one out, but I know that the Immigration Service should have provided more specific regulatory guidance as to what an immigration judge is required to do at the outset of the proceedings. An immigration judge must tell an alien what relief he's entitled to because that appears on the notice to appear in that is served on the alien. The problem is that this judge didn't do that. He just assumed that he was going to apply for asylum. At the end of the hearing, he says, I'm sorry, but you're statutorily ineligible for voluntary departure because you've opted for a hearing and because you've been served with a notice to appear. This particular petitioner was eligible for voluntary departure at the beginning of the hearing. According to the statute, if he opted for a hearing on his asylum application, he forfeited that right statutorily to voluntary departure at the conclusion of the hearing. in the case of an asylum applicant, this could be rather dreadful. In the case of anybody else, I think that there should be regulations that tell and specify that the judge is obligated to obtain a knowing and informed waiver of the right to statutory voluntary departure if the alien chooses on a certain course of conduct at the beginning of the proceeding. The problem here is that the board, which we raised this issue to the board in our motion to reopen, the board said, no, the duty really lies with the attorney and you don't have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which is beside the point. The regulation clearly provides that the immigration judge must advise the alien of the relief that he's entitled to at the outset. He's to advise him that he has a right to a hearing. There's nothing in the regulations that say that if a person has been served with a notice to appear within 12 months of physical presence, that statutory right is forfeited if they request a hearing. The statute is broad enough to include any hearing, but in the case of asylum applicants, that has a problem. It's very problematical because it's a denial of due process. The motion to reopen, we contend, was erroneously denied. The board termed whatever Eritrea has been doing lately to harass and torture its citizens by rounding them up for this supposed military and national service requirement, we contend the board said was perfectly reasonable. Every country has the right to demand military service, but that isn't what our evidence that we submitted in connection with our motion to reopen.
Tell me about that evidence. What did you submit?
We submitted, first of all, the State Department report. Secondly, we submitted various articles, particularly Human Rights Watch, which showed that this military service requirement was really a pretext for slave labor.
What does the country report say? This would be the country report.
This is the 2002.
That's right.
It says that that Jehovah's Witnesses and other persons were being tortured and being forced to comply with the military service requirement by being tortured and being subject to physical harm. I believe my reply brief does discuss that in detail and cites
Is that all it says? I mean, it does say, does it not, the 2002 report that Jehovah's Witnesses are being singled out for
Correct.
Particularly harsh treatment?
Correct. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't remember everything all at once.
No, isn't that kind of important, though? In other words, your guy is going back to a country with a single out people of his religion and give him a harder time.
Correct.
Now, what did the board have to say about that in denying the petition?
It said nothing.
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 So it overlooked that particular
completely
question.
Because what it did do, it said that he hadn't corrected the deficiencies noted by the immigration judge in the order, not mentioning what those deficiencies were. So we can only suppose that the board said, you didn't prove to us that you were a Jehovah's Witness for the last 14 years prior to entry, which of course is something he can't prove. The board absolutely avoided any mention of the religious aspect of this particular citizen's refusal to serve. The other side of the issue is that because the petitioner didn't vote in the national referendum, he was denied, according to Eritrea's proclamation in 1994, he was denied the right of citizenship. This might be somewhat inconsistent with the fact that he got a passport in 1996, but the only reason why he got a passport in 1996 was because the Eritrean government didn't know that he was a Jehovah's Witness until he applied for a trade license. When he applied for a trade license, then it was knowledge of his religious affiliation and the impediment that posed to the issues of a trade license resulted in the denial of the trade license. The judge does not explain why he ignores this piece of evidence.
Forgive me, I'm going to take you somewhere else. Do we know the status of the deportation proceedings against Mr. G's wife?
It's before this court, and I have a briefing schedule, Your Honor. She is claiming, and he is also casting his motion to reopen in terms of the larger picture of doom here. But if she's included in his asylum application,
yes.
Obviously his U.S. citizen daughter isn't. But she is contending that she would be not accepted in Eritrea. She would be deported to Ethiopia, assuming Ethiopia even accepts it. Because of this crazy border war since 1998 to 2000, nationality is not a clear-cut issue in either country, so people are just in detention camps suffering miserably, and our evidence does show that. She is, we have a briefing schedule, and we will continue to file briefs with this court asserting that her right is just as important as what he's asserted here. Relative to the CAT claim, I want to just briefly touch on that because this court has come out with two very important decisions, if I can pronounce it correctly, Oforji and Olowo, in which the two women who had not been subjected to female genital mutilation asserted those claims on behalf of their citizen daughter. But I think my time is up.
Well, so you're into your rebuttal time if you want to say that. Okay, thank you, Ms. Fasciati. Ms. Gordon?
May it please the court, Michelle Gordon for John Ashcroft in this proceeding. The court has before it two final removal orders, one from the immigration judge's decision, which is reviewed for whether or not there's evidence compelling a different result, and one, the denial of the motion to reopen, which should be reviewed for an abuse of discretion. Given the record in this case and the court's authoritative controlling case law with respect to at least two of the claims.
Well, you have the standard problem that the immigration judge's opinion is incoherent. If you go through it, I don't know what's going on here. I'm looking at page 6 of his opinion or at the end of the blue brief. So he says, respondent asserting a member of a religious group which is being the subject of heightened attention in Eritrea. Heightened? What's heightened attention?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what it is at the immigration
Right, precisely. We don't know what he's talking about. Then he says, he considers the internal consistency of respondent's claim, and while there are certain aspects which raise questions, overall respondent has testified consistently.
Yes.
Now, does that mean truthfully or what?
I think what the immigration judge was saying here was that, first of all, there was no finding of past persecution because of the denial of a business license in one instance in 1996. And then the immigration judge goes on to find that with respect to the specific areas that Mr. Gevermandine testified about, he didn't meet his burden to establish a well-founded fear.
But if he was testifying consistently, doesn't that mean that he is a Jehovah's Witness? Otherwise, his testimony would be radically inconsistent.
I'm not sure that the immigration judge didn't make a finding here that he did not believe that he was not a Jehovah's Witness. This is not a credibility finding.
That's the problem, it seems to me, is that this really is a case a lot like Muir, where the immigration didn't find that Mr. Gevermandine was or is a Jehovah's Witness, but neither did he find that he was not.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the problem in Muir was that the immigration judge made a finding that the individual could go back to Eritrea and hide his religion. There was no such finding in this case, and so a remand is not required. Instead,
he says, this is on page 70, he says, respondent has not been able to offer any type of documentation or persuasive evidence which would have this court accept fully the notion that he was a Jehovah's Witness in Eritrea. What does that mean, accept fully? How could you accept partially the notion that he was a Jehovah's Witness? What would that mean?
Well, I think what's important here is that the immigration judge didn't render his ruling based on that finding. He made that statement. But what the immigration judge did was say, I'm going to assume that this individual is a Jehovah's Witness. And I'm
Where
going
do
to
you
find.
That?
Well, I think that's implicit in the analysis, because at the end of the decision, what it is that the immigration judge says is that I find there's no well-founded fear of persecution because this person did not suffer the same difficulties as other individuals who are Jehovah's Witnesses in Eritrea. He was able to enter the country and exit the country without any difficulties.
Wait a minute, but he said, and it's completely incoherent. You look at page 9, assuming that the letter submitted by the respondent, which references the denial of a license in Eritrea as authentic, this court would find that the document and denial of a license doesn't rise to a level considered to be persecution under the Act. Well, according to Gevermandine's testimony, he was denied the license because he's a Jehovah's Witness.
According to the letter, he was denied the license. And even
he testified that it was because he was a Jehovah's Witness. They told him, you're being denied the license because you're a Jehovah's Witness. Now, the immigration judge, he didn't comment on that testimony.
But the basis of the claim here, and also the letter, and I think even the testimony, indicates that he was denied the license because he had not performed national service, which puts this case on all fours with the court's decision in TESFU, in which the court found that a sovereign nation has the right to...
But look, it's one thing... Well, for one thing which is not discussed here is whether... Does Eritrea have any concept of conscientious objection?
I'm not sure from the State Department country reports that that's entirely clear. Even if it doesn't, Your Honor, this court has already found that Eritrea's national service program is well within that country's rights, and that an individual, it can punish its citizens without it being persecution if an individual has not performed such national service. In this regard, and with respect to a well-founded fear of persecution, what the record reflects is that all of Eritrea's citizens are asked to perform national service, not just Jehovah's Witnesses. Second of all, that the requirement is imposed for individuals between the ages of 18 to 40. Mr. Gebremendin, according to his asylum application, is approaching the age of 40 in about September of this year. Here, this is a case where there's just a claim based on one theory. That's the refusal to perform national service, and that's what makes this case controlled by this court's decision.
Well, no, he's clearly trying to... I mean, there's a good deal of evidence that Eritrea... persecute Jehovah's Witnesses.
The government, you
don't agree with that?
The government disputes that contention. Mm-hmm. That's something also in Muhur that the court made a point to find that the government did not contest that finding.
Well,
but here
we
do contest.
On what basis do you dispute that?
Well, what this Department of State country report shows is that there is widespread societal discrimination against Jehovah's Witnesses in Eritrea. But there has been no finding. That's a question for the Attorney General to answer. And there has been no finding here, and the government disputes whether or not that societal discrimination arises.
Well, if there's no finding, how can we sustain the order? In other words, neither the immigration judge nor the Bureau of Immigration Appeals has decided whether there's persecution of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Well, I think there has been a finding in this particular case, and it's consistent with what this court has found.
There is a finding here?
Well, there's a finding that there was no persecution in this case. The denial of a business...
He didn't find whether or not this man is or was a Jehovah's Witness. I mean, you can just comb through that opinion, and you're just not going to find that. You can imagine it, you can impute it, you can incite it, but you're not going to find it. And that's the problem here.
Well, I don't know that it presents a problem, Your Honor, because what it is that the immigration judge did was say, no well-founded fear, even assuming that this person has met his burden to show that he is a Jehovah's Witness on this record. And here are the reasons why. Because he was denied a business license one time in 1996. When he went to the Netherlands, despite that action, he did not seek asylum in that country. Because he has been able to exit the country and enter the country without any difficulties, such as other Jehovah's Witnesses in Eritrea face.
And well, you mean he's a favored Jehovah's Witness, or isn't a Jehovah's Witness at all?
I only mean to say that on this record he has not established that he has been persecuted as a Jehovah's Witness in Eritrea, and that based on the claims that are made here, and because there were no errors in the immigration.
What if you have a country that persecutes a group, and no question it persecutes it, but one person is very good at concealing his membership in the group? Does that mean he is not a victim of persecution? Is that your theory?
No, Your Honor, that's not the theory here, and that was what the problem was.
It sounds like your theory.
No, Your Honor.
You admit there's persecution against Jehovah's Witnesses, but you say there wasn't persecution against him.
No, we're not admitting that there's
persecution against Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm sure there were Jews in Germany in the 30s who could pass as, you know, non-Jews, and so they were left alone, right? So.
Well, Your Honor, the government is not conceding that there's persecution of Jehovah's Witnesses in
Eritrea. Oh, I thought you said that a minute ago.
No, what I'm saying is that what the record reflects and what the Department of State's country reports reflect is that there is societal discrimination, but even in TESFU, the court acknowledged that there was that societal discrimination.
Well, it's official. I mean, it's not just social, right?
The 202 report says, although persons from other religious groups, including Muslims, mm-hmm. reportedly have been punished in past years for failure to participate in national service, only members of Jehovah's Witnesses have been subject to dismissal from the civil service, revocation of their trading licenses, eviction from government-owned housing, and denial of passports, identity cards, and exit visas.
Yes, and so what the report shows is that they are discriminated against because they are viewed as being unpatriotic for not performing national service.
But yes,
not on
yes,
account
yes.
of religion, which is the protected basis in this case. What the country report shows is that there it acknowledges that there is this discrimination, but that it is because individuals in Eritrea view Jehovah's Witnesses as being unpatriotic, but not because it is directed at their religion. And in fact, what the record shows is that to the extent that there are religious restrictions in Eritrea, they are imposed on other religious groups as well, not just Jehovah's Witnesses.
But according to the report here, not as stringently.
That's true, Your Honor, and that goes back to the point of discrimination that even in Tetsu, this court acknowledged that there is mistreatment of Jehovah's Witnesses there, but that does not rise to the level of persecution, especially with respect or in the context of the claims that are raised here, which is the refusal to perform national service and whether or not he faces persecution on that ground. If there are no further questions on that, I will just quickly address the motion to reopen claims. The claim based on the wife's nationality, the board properly found that was procedurally defaulted. The evidence or the facts that were presented in the motion to reopen were available to him at the time of the immigration judge's October 1998 decision.
In terms of the risk of female genital mutilation, isn't this case different from Olawa in the sense that both parents are in deportation proceedings? In other words, isn't there a real chance that the daughter will be constructively deported?
Well, Your Honor, I think that Olawa is different in that case there was testimony on the record that the individuals would take their daughter back to Nigeria and that they were powerless to stop the potential harm to her. In this case, we have a last-minute allegation in the reply brief that the daughter, United States citizen daughter, will be taken back to Eritrea. I think that the case is different just from the testimonial standpoint, but it is still the same or is still controlled by Olawa in the sense that Mr. Gebremedin hasn't established a legal theory that will allow him to raise it or sustain a derivative torture claim because of his United States citizen daughter's, well, because of her citizenship here in the United States. She won't be constructively deported. She has every right and entitlement to remain here in the country.
She's what, like 2 years old?
I believe she's five.
Five.
I believe she's five now, yeah.
Who would she stay with, do you think?
I think I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Would the service deport these people without knowing the answer to that?
The service has been made aware of this case and the allegation in this case in the reply brief, and it will act consistently with what the court has demanded through the Olawa decision. If there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Gordon. Ms. Spashati, how much time does she have? 5 minutes?
In both the two cases, Ojafor and Olawa, neither of the aliens said that they would experience torture by virtue of the torture to be inflicted on their citizen daughter. And I address this court to the regulations that define what torture is. Section 1208.19A4 IV. It says that torture includes mental pain and suffering which is prolonged and results from the threat that another person will be imminently subjected to death, severe physical pain, or suffering. Conceivably encompasses this situation where this petitioner, who will either be in jail or tortured himself, is her mother, the child's mother, will be deported to Ethiopia in a detention camp, will face the female genital mutilation that will cause the father, who can't protect her.
Well, only if they bring the child with them. She has the right to remain in the United States.
But there's nobody here to care for her.
Well, foster care, I suppose.
Well, I suppose that, but it's not so much
not attractive, but I...
It's not so much that the child has a direct claim to torture, it's because the parents...
No, I understand, but you're tying it to the fact that the child will be subjected to this procedure, but only if she goes back with her parents.
I would hope that
in the absence of a very clear case of torture to the alien himself, I would hope that we wouldn't dismiss the possibility that torture would also include torture to the alien if the parent, as parent, would see and be unable to prevent torture to a child. Regardless of
whether... Well, they are able to prevent it. They just leave her in the United States. I know it's unattractive, but it's not torture.
I'm not too sure that that would be a salutary, but the point of the matter is that you have to start with the premise that the alien doesn't have a torture claim in his or her own right before you can even jump to the issue of whether or not the child might be derivative.
I'm not sure what that risk, whether there really is that risk, because it's usually the family that insists on the procedure. And it's Muslims, isn't it? It's not universal. Jehovah's Witnesses don't do this stuff.
Eritrea and Ethiopia both have widespread practice.
No, I know it's widespread, but it depends on the family, and particularly, I believe it's a Muslim practice. I don't think it's universal even in East Africa.
It perhaps could also be Christian Orthodox, because it is a societal practice.
But the mother doesn't want this done.
I don't know. There isn't any evidence whether the mother does or she doesn't. The question here is whether or not he's allowed to have a hearing to amplify his basis for asserting female genital mutilation on behalf of his daughter. We don't know what plans the father has, whether the mother has it, had it, or whether the mother's opposed. We know nothing about this. But the fact is that unless he doesn't show, he's not bootstrapping. If this is a clear case of bootstrapping his own invalid claim to the torture convention, then obviously this court doesn't have to go any further. But that's not entirely clear from the way he presented his case on his motion to reopen. There is evidence that Jehovah's Witnesses are being tortured if they refuse military service. Might I address one small point? Let me present the court with a hypothetical. I'm a Catholic, and if my religion forbids me to go to military service, does that make me unpatriotic? Therefore, are all Catholics unpatriotic? Therefore, is it justifiable that my government throw me in jail because I'm a Catholic, because I refuse military service? In other words, the way the government phrases its position in this case is that it's not the, it's, he's, his, whatever
but
he's saying.
But you haven't argued this, have you? I mean, what you're saying now is that denial of conscientious objection status might be a form of persecution. But you didn't argue that in your brief.
I believe I did, I pointed out in my reply brief that Eritrea...
But is there any law on this?
Eritrea.
Quakers, I mean, for example, I don't believe Great Britain recognized conscientious objection status in World War I. So anyone who's a conscientious objector would be jailed. Now, would that be persecution, or is it regarded as a national choice whether to recognize conscientious objector status?
If Britain did not recognize conscientious objector status, that didn't necessarily tie itself to a religious objection. It would probably tie itself to a question of matter of conscience rather than religion. If Britain said that all Anglicans who refuse military service...
Well, presumably Quakers were all...
Well, Quakers, whatever. Then there might be a real case of persecution, even under English law.
Then again, if Britain had said that Quakers will be punished more severely than Anglicans mm-hmm. for refusing, there'd be no question.
Absolutely no question.
That's your case, is it not?
That's absolutely my case. I have no further... Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Speciati, and thank you to both counsel.